You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Ew.
And Evan Bernstein.
I like when Wednesday is the 11th because you know what that means for Friday. Friday's
yes.
The 13th.
Yeah. Not that means anything.
Good luck, everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Friday I will be at an anti-superstition gathering at Logical LA. I cannot wait.
Welcome to my town.
So much fun. Yes. I hope we can see each other.
And Kara, welcome back from.
Thanks.
Yeah, Hawaii. Awesome to have you back.
I know it's been so long.
It's
How did
been
that
a
go
year.
Over? Yeah,
Aloha.
It's 2017 already. How did that go over? The first episode of 2017, was it fun with George?
It was awesome. I swept everybody in science or fiction.
Yeah,
I wasn't there.
Yeah, I was so awesome. Happy. Uh huh. Kara, you missed the first episode, and you're in the lead in science or fiction.
All right, Kara, we'll start us off with what's the word?
Yeah, so the word this week is a fun one. I know it's probably one of Bob's. I don't know, Bob, is this one of your top words? Parallax?
Oh, yeah. Parallax,
it's
second baby.
Word.
It's awesome
yeah.
stuff.
All right. So according to Merriam-Webster, we'll start with that. Parallax is the apparent displacement or the difference in apparent direction of an object as seen from two different points that are not on a straight line with the object. So that's a little bit jargony, but we'll dig into it, especially the angular difference in direction of a celestial body as measured from two points on Earth's orbit. And of course, that's where parallax really becomes important, I think, to us in science. So a good kind of example of this is, it's kind of like triangulation, right? How are astronomers able to estimate the difference of objects in space knowing that Earth is on a course around the sun? So what they do is they measure the star's movement against the background of more distant stars over the course of that movement around the sun. And by looking at that difference, they can get a better idea of exactly how far apart those things really are. A good kind of cheap and dirty way to play with this method is the same way that, have you guys ever done this where you have obviously one dominant eye and you can test which eye is dominant? If
yes.
you hold your finger over something in the distance, you close one eye and your finger stays in the same spot. You close the other eye and the finger seems to jump a little bit.
Yep. Yeah, it does
That's
all the time.
Very similar to what we're talking about with parallax. We have to be able to triangulate that difference to know exactly where your finger is because your eyes are in two different positions to be able to figure it out. The cool thing about parallax, I think, and what Steve brought up too, is parallax's relationship to parsec. So let's
yes.
first talk about the etymology of parallax. It's from Middle French parallax from the 1570s, which goes back to the Greek parallaxis before that. It refers to change, alteration, inclination. And even before that, you can kind of break it down into para and elasine, which is, yeah, also Greek, which means to change. Similarly, when we look at the word parsec, which you guys know what a parsec is, right? That's a unit of measure.
Yeah. 3.26 light years, parallax second.
There you go. And that's the thing. when we think about astronomers and how they actually talk, they don't usually really use light years that often. They actually talk in parsec.
Well, not even parsecs, really. I would say, you hear things like megaparsec, gigaparsec, mm-hmm. really vast distances
That's
in
true.
Space.
Yeah. So just like you said, Bob, a parsec is a unit of measure for interstellar space that's equal to 3.26 light years. It's the distance to an object having a parallax of 1 second as seen from points separated by one astronomical unit.
That's a good way to put
That's
it.
That's really where uh-huh. the word comes from. It's it actually was first coined in 1913. And if you break down the words parallax and second and you take the first syllable of each, it becomes parsec, which I think is so cool. And I'm not sure
it's a cool
lot of
word. It's just a cool
know
word.
Know about that connection.
And do you know, Kara, why they use AU as the baseline?
The astronomical unit? I'm
yeah.
not sure. Why would they use
Earth's
that?
Orbit, right, Steve?
Earth's orbit, because what we're doing is looking at stars at one point in Earth's orbit and then comparing it their positions when observed at a time of the year when the Earth is in a different point in its mm-hmm. in its orbit. So basically, we're using the movement of the Earth around the sun to generate the parallax.
And right. so clever. Just like the genius that is the metric system, it's always yeah. easier when you base it on kind of that single unit of one.
And yeah. for close stars, you could then make a really skinny triangle, and you could actually find the distance very, very accurately. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. that only works for very close stars, because once you get a certain distance away, then the parallax is so tiny that you can't even measure it. And then you need standard candles, and that's where the yeah. standard candles come in, like Cepheid variable stars and supernovas, which gave us the expansion of the increasing expansion of the universe. So
yeah, parallax is good to about 100 parsecs, which is about 326 light years. That's right. about it. Beyond that,
it's too tiny to measure.
Yeah. Well, Bob, speaking of clever astronomers, mm-hmm. some astronomers have made an interesting prediction about something we should be seeing in about 5 years. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's not just interesting. It's unprecedented, an unprecedented prediction that they claim that a binary star collision will create a nova in the night sky in 2022, which will appear as a new naked eye visible star. And so the two big takeaways here is that this prediction has never been successfully made in the past, and this is going to be a naked eye star. I mean, you could see new stuff and really cool stuff in a telescope all the time, but the stuff that you could see naked eye, that's really amazing stuff that everybody can see just by looking up in the night sky, as long as they don't have too much light pollution. So this prediction was made by astronomers at Calvin College University in Michigan. The forecast was made officially at a press conference, which is kind of ironic that this happened, I think, on the day of the Epiphany, which apparently commemorates the visit of the three wise men who supposedly followed the new star of Bethlehem. So that was kind of an interesting coincidence there, the new star. So apparently this new star is being called the Boom Star. Boom, baby. Sorry, I just saw the Emperor's New Groove again.
That's a good show.
So binary star – yeah. That is such a damn good movie. So the binary star system is named KIC 9832227. There's that creativity. Thanks, guys. It's about 1,800 light years away. So it's not really close, but it's not very far. Close enough. It's a binary star system. The separation is incredibly tight. It's an 11-hour orbit around one another. These two relatively low mass stars, and it's not an ordinary binary either. This is called a contact binary, meaning that they are actually sharing a stellar atmosphere. If you can kind of some websites are comparing it to a peanut. But they do share the stellar atmosphere, which is really cool. And you've probably seen pictures of it. It kind of looks like a dumbbell type thing. If they do collide, and if and when, I guess, it will create what's called a red nova, which I had not heard before. A red nova has a distinctive red color, as you might imagine, invisible light. And that will dim over many, many months and deepen. But then over time, its infrared output gets more and more intense. So it's aptly named a red nova. So if a prediction like this has never been done, why are they so confident? And well, this is why. Because in 2008, there was another pair of binary stars with the slightly better, or maybe more than slightly, a better name, V1309 Scorpii, which is kind of a cool name. These two binary stars collided, and it took everybody by surprise. So they went back into the data that was collected before the collision, and they saw a pattern of increase in the orbital speed. So the orbital period decreased at an increasing rate. And they realized that the explosion could have potentially been predicted if they were aware of that. So, and I'm sure you can now guess, in 2013, the scientists noticed that the orbital speed for the binaries in K1C were increasing, and it looked very familiar. The orbital speed was increasing in the same way that Scorpii was increasing in 2008. So, based on this previous pattern, they predicted that the two stars should collide in 2022, creating a nova visible to the naked eye, seen as a point of light as bright as Polaris, potentially, maybe even brighter, which would be even cooler. It would be among the most brightest thing, you know, the brightest things in the night sky. But this is all, of course, assuming that the process is similar enough to the Scorpii event in 2008. You know, there could be some subtleties and quirks in this binary system that are significantly different enough to Scorpii that it would be they would be off by more than they anticipate. So come 2022, give or take a year, so they're giving themselves a bit of a buffer. It's not like they could predict this within a month. It could happen in 2021 or 2023 potentially. So I'm sure a lot of people will be observing the skies near constellation Cygnus, where this is going to happen, and trying to be the first person or people to spot the new star, because that would be, I would think that'd be pretty coveted to be the first person to see this new star blink on in the night sky. And what a video that would make, right? I mean, I can't wait to see that video if somebody actually catches mm-hmm. it, to see, you know, to see a bunch of stars. And this would be, I think, right by the, what is it called? The Southern Cross, to look at these stars and then bam, see a new star appear out of nowhere. That would be, or a nova appear out of nowhere. That would be quite special. And I'm sure it would go hopefully viral on YouTube.
So, I mean, that's what I love about science, right? We make very concrete predictions, you know, and then the veracity of what the astronomers think, you know, they understand will be tested with something very specific. Either the star will, the nova will appear or it won't. And if it does, that's pretty good confirmation that they know what they're talking about, you know? That's
cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And if it doesn't, they'll go back to the drawing board. You know, they won't make excuses, you know, they'll just
right.
say, okay, well, clearly we got something wrong. Let's figure out what's really going on.
Yeah, they won't say silly stuff like, well, it did happen, but there was kind of a lot of dust in the way, and that's why we can't see it, but maybe we'll, you know, the dust will clear next year. We'll see it next year. Like,
all right, well, we've been talking a lot about fake news and disregard for truth, et cetera, and, you know, a lot of people have asked me, what could we do about it? And it's really, at this point, it's not really clear. I know Facebook is trying to change the rules by which they promote news items. But Jay, you're going to tell us about maybe some other ideas about what we could do to combat the epidemic of fake news.
Yeah, not too long ago, November of 2016, an environmental science professor named Nathan Phillips noticed that the news site Breitbart News had an ad on their site. Breitbart, whatever. Breitbart, I like to mispronounce these assholes' names. Breitbarden News. What happened was he noticed that an ad was on Breitbart News, thank you, for Duke University and other universities. And since he actually he received his degree from Duke, he realized that Duke University officials probably did not know their ads were appearing on that website. And he asked himself a very simple question. Why would an environmental science program at Duke want their university promoted on a website that denies the existence of climate change? So to further explain, just so you guys get the big picture here, Duke University, as an example, pays to have its ads shown all over the web, right? They want people to go to their university. So they pay a company to distribute their ads, and you might see them on, you know, one of hundreds of websites that you visit, you know, a little banner ad, which we all are very used to seeing even in the middle of, say, blogs that we read or whatever. So Breitbart displays these paid ads on their site, and they make good money doing it since they got a ton of people that visit that site every day. So indirectly, Breitbart is making money off of Duke University. Not directly, but absolutely indirectly through the intermediary company that places the ads. So Phillips contacted Duke, and after some back and forth, Duke assured him that their ads were not going to appear on that news aggregator site anymore. You know, so what he did, in essence, was become an activist, and he took action against misinformation and fake news. Now, unrelated, around the same time, a company, or I shouldn't even say a company, a organization, started to send out thousands of tweets that were contacting companies to let them know that things like this were happening. Now, they call themselves Sleeping Giants, and they actually have done a remarkable job in the very short time since last November to contact these thousands of companies, and over 400 of the companies that they've contacted have responded saying that they are going to remove their ads from this site and other sites like it. That is awesome. And it is a very simple way to fight back against the fake news. And the cool thing about this is anybody can do it. Now, what they say is all you need to do is take a screenshot of the ad on say, you know, that or, you know, any kind of news aggregator site that you feel like is compromised. You take a screenshot, especially if the ad is next to a piece of fake news or something bad, you know, something that is either, you know, poor journalism or something that you feel the organization would be upset about, and you tweet it. You know, this is starting to snowball. I mean, I am reading about other people doing it, and it seems to be like one of the very easy things that people can do. You could spend 15 minutes hunting and pecking around, and then, you know, you put a post up on Twitter, and companies want to respond to this type of thing. Now, I happen to work for a global company, and, you know, we are very cautious about lots of things that happen online. We want to be very, we want our customers to be satisfied with our products, and we listen to and read our reviews very carefully, and we respond to them. It's very typical for companies like this that consider their company a brand to be very cautious with the brand and how it's perceived. And I think that on top of that, executives at the companies are actually upset when they find out facts like this. So I put it to you as an SGU listener, someone that cares about the truth and someone that cares about not spreading misinformation. If you feel like you have any free time on any average day during your lunch hour or whatever, why don't you take a look and see if there's anything you can find that you think, hey, maybe this company would like to know that their ad is being displayed on this website or, you know, alongside this horrible news. Take a screenshot and tweet it and see what happens.
Cool.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if that kind of effort has any net effect. Because, you know, my fear is always that, you know, anything that we try to do for quality control, they'll just turn it around and use it to fight back against the people who are calling them out on their bullshit, right? So, like, the moment that the term fake news, you know, was applied to actually fake manufactured, you know, BS, the people who were spreading the BS immediately turned around and called anything they disagreed with fake news.
Yeah.
You know?
But I think there is a lot of power in advertising. You know, it really is, in many ways, a driver of our economy. And we've seen this happen a lot where, and again, this happens more in traditional journalism, but where a traditional journalist may have done or said something that advertisers feel like is outside of ethical boundaries or something that they don't want their brands associated with, and they'll pull their advertisements, and that person will get fired because they can't keep their show afloat.
Yeah.
Like, this does happen. So it is an interesting way to try and undermine that using capitalism, like, kind of for good, I guess.
Using market forces. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the science and skeptical activists and people that are advocates for these things, like our audience, I trust these people more than I trust the average person out there, because, you know, we like to educate ourselves about science and critical thinking. So yeah. I mean, I think we're the right people to be doing this. You know, again, don't be a dick. You know, I would say the company will absolutely respond to a polite and nice and concerned note over something like, oh God, can you believe this jerky company is putting their ads on this site or whatever? And a lot of times, of course, I'll remind you that a lot of the companies don't know where their ads are showing up. And they do have the ability to go into a back-end system and limit where their ads are distributed to. You know, but most of the companies don't do it because they're like, yeah, just get the biggest reach that they can. And they're not really thinking, oh, wait, what site is this actually going to show up on?
Yeah, there's a lot of automated advertising. And I think the article, Jay, that you're referring to estimated that there's like $22 billion in ads every year that are just programmed. You know, no one's deciding exactly what's going where. It's just happening automatically.
Absolutely. I mean, like, even as an example, some of the ads you'll see on our sites, you know, we have a service that pays us to display those ads, and I can go in to the back end system and edit out ads from companies that are showing stuff that we really don't want to. The problem is, and I think everybody knows what I'm about to say, is that the vast majority of the ads that come through a lot of these companies are kind of junky.
Yeah, it's a lot of
it's clickbait junk food, you know, and it is a way for bloggers and people like us to make some type of cash flow to help us, you know, pay the bills. And I do think it has its place, but yeah, lines do get crossed. I see ads on some of our blogs. I'm like, you know, I don't like that, and I'll get rid of it. But other things and new things pop up all the time. It's kind of like whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. All right, Evan, you're going to tell us, this is an interesting news item. It's really a story. The real story here is just bad science reporting, which again, we talk about a lot, but this is kind of a funny example of it.
Sure is. And this was brought to our attention by SGU listener Craig Good. The Headline reads, neuroscience says listening to this song reduces anxiety by up to 65%. What's the song? Well, hang on a minute. We'll get there. So the article refers to a science-backed tip to help people reduce stress, namely sound therapy. And according to the article, they report that scientists have suggested that people make a playlist of 10 songs, 10 songs of which are found to be the most relaxing on Earth. That's what they write. They say that sound therapies have long been popular as a way of relaxing and restoring one's health. For centuries, indigenous creatures have used music to enhance well-being and improve health conditions. All well and fine.
I hate everything about this.
but wait a minute, it gets better. Now neuroscientists, it gets better, out of the UK have specified which songs give you the most the most return for your stress-relieving musical buck.
What?
And the study was conducted on participants who attempted to solve difficult puzzles as quickly as possible while connected to sensors. The puzzles induced a certain level of stress, and participants listened to different songs while researchers measured brain activity as well as physiological states that included heart rate, blood pressure, and rate of breathing. Okay, so Steve, pausing here, how does that happen? So what sort of brain activity denotes indications of elevated stress, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, those are non-specific. But yeah, you could use things like blood pressure and heart rate.
And like galvanic skin response, I guess.
You're measuring sympathetic tone,
right?
Really, but and using that as a marker for stress.
It's like a lie detector test.
Yeah, it's not that
well,
part
I would say
of
it's
it
more
is
reliable.
It's not crazy, but you just have to be very careful in how you interpret the results.
But there is a definitive way to measure it. Is
well, I don't know if it's definitive that you're definitively measuring stress. It's just a way to measure sympathetic response.
Yeah,
and then you have to
you're assuming that relates to stress,
which we assume stress. Okay, so we've got so take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, it's a marker.
The article continues, and they talk to a Dr. David Lewis Hodgson of Mind Lab International, and they were the ones who conducted this research that they're reporting about. And according to their research, the one song, it's called Weightless, resulted in a striking 65% reduction in the participants' overall anxiety and a 35% reduction in their usual physiological resting rates. So, yeah, that seems impressive. You go to look for the link somewhere here to the actual study, right, to see exactly what it's telling you. And there is no link. So you do an internet search looking for the study, and you can't find it on the internet. Okay. So at this point, I mean, the article kind of goes on to explain in a little more detail, but I got curious. I'm like, well, where's the study? We said we want to, you know, see what it really does say. So I actually sent an email out to the folks at Mind Lab International who performed the study, and I said, where can I find it? And they took the time to actually respond. I'll read you their whole response. It says, hi, Evan. This was a case of the press getting overeager with their reporting. We did a small study nearly 4 years ago. Don't know why this is news today. But 4 years ago to look at the relaxing effect of 20 music tracks, which were chosen through a survey. We measured relaxation with skin conductance. This measures autonomic arousal. We had a sample of 24 people. We found that the Marconi Union song Weightless was the most relaxing track of the ones we tested. I doubt it's the world's most relaxing song in the world. We conducted this research for a commercial client and as such are not at liberty to share the paper without their permission.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was nice that they got back to me, and that revealed a lot. And boy, getting back to the main point that Steve, you brought up at the beginning, this whole article is kind of, I don't know, throwaway as far as I'm concerned.
It's crap. I mean, the reporting here is utter crap. So, you know, the things that I don't like throwing the word therapy at the end of things just to, oh, this is, you know, music therapy. No, it's listening to music. That's what it is. You know?
I love that. It's just, it's relaxing at the end of the day.
Everything is blank therapy, you know? So that it waters down that term to that point where it means nothing, or it's trying to imply that there's something medicinal going on when it's just, you know, an activity that you're engaging in. And sure, listening to certain kinds of music could be relaxing. Sure, I have no problem with that. And you may be able to measure that with galvanic skin response or whatever. But that's it. That's about it. But they throw in like it's healing. No, there's nothing healing about it. Indigenous cultures, who cares? I mean, it's all those common tropes, you know, that doesn't really mean anything. And of course, the study itself is a ridiculously small study, making a limited comparison, and is not peer reviewed or published as far as we know, right? It was just done. It was a proprietary study for a company, and that's it.
A private company that wanted to do this.
So this is like barely even science. You know what I mean? It doesn't really even qualify. But what you take away from this is, listening to some kinds of music are relaxing, which is not anything new, and that's it. But I mean, it's amazing how, you know, this journalist took this into neuroscience. That's the other thing. Neuroscience says, just through throwing out the neuroscience from listening to this song reduces anxiety by up to 65%. No, it doesn't. Neuroscience doesn't say that.
Yeah, it's the danger of just going with the headlines. Yeah.
Which is what most people read, right? And I feel bad for the scientist too, because you can tell in his response how incredibly conservative he was in talking about it, which is the right way for a scientist to be, right? Like, how did this like little study that we did get so blown out of proportion? Because a lot of times there's such a disconnect between the scientists and the science, and then the journalists that just run away with it.
I wish I'd done a follow-up question with him and asked him how many people or journalists or other curious minds contacted them to find out where the study was or how they could see it, because that's really what you're looking for when you are reading articles reporting on science. You want to see good references. Even if you don't fully understand it, you can have somebody you know help you translate it, someone who is in the field, whatever. It's usually there for to be had, but no such case here.
And speaking of the press getting ahead of themselves, Kara, this actually relates to your news item as well. We mentioned this actually briefly on the show last week when you weren't there, and I complained about the reporting, which was misleading. Let's delve into it with a little more detail. So the bottom line is, have scientists discovered a new organ that we didn't know was there before?
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I even shared a story about this. I shared a story on a Discovery blog about the mesentery, and it was an interesting story, and I thought the reporting was pretty solid, other than this main question, which is, a new organ has been discovered. We now have 79 instead of 78 organs, both of which are just utter crap, because we've known about the mesentery for thousands of years. And it's not even that it's new that scientists or doctors are now thinking that the mesentery is one continuous organ. Even that's old. Leonardo da Vinci drew it as one continuous organ in his anatomical drawings. So it's just that the conversation is now being had about whether or not, as a community, it should be viewed as one continuous organ and what we can learn from that. And so I thought it was really cool that on this Discovery blog called The Crux, so first there was an article about it under Debrief by Nathaniel Sharping, and that was published on January 3rd, 2017. And then under the blog The Crux by Carl Engelking on January 6th, so 4 days later, he published a story called We Got the Mesentery News All Wrong. And he kind of goes point by point into what basically all of the news outlets did, including themselves, when they pounced on this journal article. It was published in The Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, actually in November, so like 2 months ago. And somehow, this always seems to happen, like one news outlet will be like, oh, this is interesting, let me write around it. And then a bunch of other news outlets will kind of piggyback that. So just like you said, Evan, there will be things that aren't even new that somehow get new traction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Wow. But so this was an article written by J. Calvin Coffey of Limerick University Hospital. He's a researcher and also a colorectal surgeon. And he was interested in how we view the mesentery. So he wrote this article called The Mesentery, Structure, Function, and Role in Disease. And it's just kind of a summary article. A lot of studies that he and his colleagues had done, and a lot of the surgical kind of practices, And like, how are we defining this organ? Are we even calling it an organ? What are some of its distinctive anatomical features, its functional features? And why is it important that we start talking about this in a way that's different than how we used to? That's really what the crux of the published article was. So like you said, Steve, a bunch of news outlets said, oh my God, we discovered a new organ. Wrong. We've always known about the mesentery. And oh my God, now we have 79 versus 78, which this follow-up blog on Discovery does a really good job of digging deep into, like, where did we come up with that number? And first they asked the researcher. Yeah, they asked the researcher who published it, and he's like, that's a fascinating question. I actually don't know who the final arbiter of that is. We don't know, A, where that number came from. This journalist could not track back where that number of 78 versus 79 came from. And we also know now, because he did a really deep dive into who is the body, kind of the arbiter of once something is called an organ. We remember when Pluto got quote unquote demoted, mm-hmm. right? Because there was an official body that sat and had a meeting and wanted to discuss whether or not we should actually categorize this as a planet or not. There isn't a body that does that for organs. And it may seem like who kind of gives a crap, because whether you call it an organ or not, it's always done the same thing and it's going to continue to do the same thing, which is kind of keep all of our guts in place. But there does seem to be, according at least to this blogger, this journalist, a really good reason for saying why it matters, whether we call it an organ. And a lot of it comes down to database science, computer science. It comes down to artificial intelligence. And at a certain point, when we want these really intricate, driven functions to do their jobs well online, we have to program them with data sets that are clear. We have to be able to label certain things as having certain parameters around them. In computer science, they actually call that ontology, which is very confusing because we're talking about not biological ontology, but computer science ontology. And it's an important facet of computer science. You have to have very clear, distinct labels and descriptions with different kind of discrete objects, so that later, as AI starts to try and categorize new information, it can use this foundational information. And if that foundational information is super messy and there's no formal agreement on how we label things or what they do, it could get messy later when biomedical science and computer science really do continue to collide. So I don't know. It's an interesting thought experiment. Why does it matter what we call something, or why does it matter how we categorize it? This is a big question in evolutionary biology, obviously. What is a species? What is a subspecies? When do we call something a genus versus a species? Historically, it was all based on morphology, just what does it look like? Then later, when we got really sophisticated technology to start looking at the genes and start looking at evolution from a genetic perspective, we could make better distinctions. And I think the mesentery news, the interesting thing about it is not that there's quote unquote a new organ. It's that it's raising all these questions about how do we even define what an organ is?
Yeah, that's the interesting question.
Yeah, because like if a bone mm-hmm. is an organ, because it's, you know, some all sorts of people have different definitions, right? A self-contained structure that's continuous that serves a function. But then some people say, no, it has to serve a vital function. And then other people say, oh, it doesn't have to be continuous, but it does have to be self-contained, like whatever that means. So a lot of people are like, well, by that definition, a bone is an organ. And we have like 206. Is that the right number?
Yeah,
bones. So right there, we have more than, you know, 67 organs. It's like people don't agree. There's still contention about whether or not the skin is an organ.
Wait. There's contention about that? I thought that was pretty much cut and dry.
Exactly.
Biggest organ, skin.
But who is the arbiter of whether or not that's cut and dry? Many anatomists still don't consider it to be an organ. Many anatomists do.
Yeah. Why does it have to be continuous? Like the thymus gland isn't continuous, mm-hmm. but that's pretty much considered one organ. So
And like the cerebellum is very different than other cortical tissue. I mean, I guess it's technically continuous, but I guess it depends on how you define continuous, because would we be saying the brain isn't an organ and the cerebellum's its own organ? I don't know.
Well, all I know is that the bottom of that Snapple lid told me that the skin was the largest organ.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There was kind of a, I don't know if you could call it a movement, but once kind of people said, oh, the skin is an organ, and it caught on, it became sort of just the known thing that the skin is the largest organ. Yeah. But before that, everybody said the liver was the largest organ.
The bottom line is that the real world is messy, and our attempts at neatly categorize it often fail. And we get into these arbitrary fuzzy boundaries, and there's no objective way to resolve it. There's no objective definition of what an organ is.
And that's why you sometimes need a group. You need like a commission.
Right. Exactly. You know, we need to get rid of the autism panel and replace it with an organ panel. Let's make an organ panel and decide these vastly more important things.
Yeah. And you'll hear about the autism panel in our upcoming segment when we interview David Gorski.
We
already recorded, which is why Bob referred.
I wonder how that'll go.
Believe me, you'll chuckle in about 12 minutes.
Yeah, so we call that, you know, by definition or by convention, and it's very important. I delve into this a lot when I'm teaching medical students. It's like, well, this is the case by convention. We do it this way because that's the way we do it. But it's interesting to know, you know, what the reasons may or may not be for why we do it a certain way, or why we, you know, categorize things in a certain way, as opposed to there's a really concrete scientific reason why this is the way it is. So it's always important to know that. It's like, what makes a disease? You know, that's the same thing. These are very fuzzy boundaries that we're dealing
with. That's true. And we often don't teach, especially probably in medical school, but even in biological science, there's just not enough time to teach all of the history and systems of these practices. So you just end up taking all this information in at face value. It's all just tangible information. And you don't really know, well, who's the guy who discovered that? And why did it take his name instead of taking a more anatomical Latin name? And it is really messy.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
It is. And etymology, I think, matters. Like, it's an important, I don't know if I would call it a science, but it's an important study because it really teaches you why we think a certain way about certain things and how they got to be what they are.
Yeah, remember the whole Valsalva maneuver debacle, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Basically, what I was taught in medical school and what I've always subsequently heard is actually only one definition that turned out not to be the original definition. It was a very long and interesting history, but it all got boiled down to this is what it is. And that's just the way it gets taught. But it's always good to try to look back at the etymology or the history of how these things came about, and you learn a lot about it. Mm-hmm. Like, you add these little questions, simple questions, become so insightful. What is an organ? What is a disease? You know, these are very, very important questions. And I think, you know, this follow-up article is very, very good. But what annoys me a lot at, you know, the initial sort of superficial science reporting is that they actually do such a disservice to the what's interesting and cool about science by boiling it down to this simplistic received wisdom that really ignores all of the real interesting thinking that goes on in science, like thinking about how we categorize stuff. It's
important. And they do themselves a disservice as a journalist because there's no story there. Like, when you dig into the history, you have more story
to
tell. And I highly recommend anybody who listens to the podcast who's in undergraduate an undergraduate program right now, whether it's in science or psychology or any of these kind of fields, if they offer a history and systems class or they offer advanced history and systems classes in your field, I definitely recommend taking them because they give your focused study so much more color. Like, those were my favorite courses. And I was bummed in my biology programs that we didn't get that kind of training. They didn't offer courses like that. But my psychology department did an incredible job of offering good history and systems courses. And I hoped that more science departments have that.
Yeah, I agree. Knowing the history of the science is a great way to really wrap your head around why we think what we do today, because how we got there is very important. Okay, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
All right, last week I played this noisy. So So we had I had quite a few people email in. One guess was, unless you guys want to take a stab at what it is.
I know exactly what that is.
I hadn't heard it yet. Ooh, that helps.
Some
is
bird.
It some type of bird? Yeah.
No, it's
bird.
It's
bird, not.
Bird is a word.
It's somebody communicating with R2-D2. Yeah.
So a listener named Jim Luxton emailed in and said, this is a shepherd giving whistle commands to a border collie.
Ooh.
I thought that was a great guess, even though he's wrong.
Oh, no.
Wow. No, I wanted him to be right.
They do that?
The actual answer is, now this was sent in by a listener named Ian Hollis, and Ian said, I just learned about this, and I think it would be a great Who's That Noisy segment. It's a dialect of Spanish from the Canary Islands that's whistled instead of spoken to make communication possible over long distances.
Whoa.
Right.
Sure.
Hmm. We had a winner this week, Baz Dahuis. Yeah, Damhuis. Baz Dahuis.
Wow, got it right the first time, Jeff.
I don't know, trying. He said, I think this week is someone whistling, but in a specific manner. It sounds like a lot of the whistling languages that come out of the Canary Islands. Very good, very good.
There you go.
That's Baz, crazy.
Yeah, so it can...
I just want to say...
And you know, I want to say, I'm Canary Islander, so I feel like I should have known that.
What if you grew up in the Canary Islands and you can't whistle?
I did pick up a few things. I noticed that people are using different techniques to whistles. There's one whistle that they do where they literally take one finger, like their pointer finger on their left or right hand, and stick it right into the middle of their mouth.
Really?
Which I never saw before. Yes, very strange.
Huh.
But then there was people that were able to whistle without putting their fingers in their mouth. And there's a lot of that one finger weird kind of hand holding thing in the mouth that I notice when they do this. I guess it might be traditional or something. I couldn't find out how far the sound can go. That was something I really wanted to know. I couldn't find any good facts about that, but this is science. This exists.
Cool.
Thank you, Ian, and good job, Baz. That was you nailed it.
Can't they just shout really loud?
I guess the high pitched frequency for some reason can cut further through the air. I don't know, Bob.
Well,
I'm not quite sure about the physics.
I do know that in terms of true long distance communication, I think you would want low frequency.
That's correct. Low frequency.
So not so
like elephants, right?
Yes,
elephants
exactly. Over miles. Exactly. It's like subsonic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there might be something cool to the physics here about why that the frequencies that they're using are effective for long distances. I don't know. Maybe someone can write in and let us know if they're an expert on Canary Island whistling.
And if you shout all day, you're going to lose your voice.
That's right.
You can whistle pretty much all day without any problem.
Good chap lips.
So this new noisy was sent in by a listener named Ben Bowles.
Not Ben Dover. Oh, God.
Be nice. Here it is. And here it is. And, and here it is.
I know exactly what that is. I know exactly what that is.
But you actually don't, Bob, and that's why this
really?
Is this week's Who's That Noisy, yes.
That's right. That was a bird. I won't tell you which one.
Do you have to identify the source of the music?
Jay.
Yes, so slow down there, Bucktooth. Listen.
I think I do know.
Then we'll talk after hours, right. Okay? But not right now. So, yes, many, many people are going to go, oh, I know what that is. That's not what I'm looking for. I want all the information. I want to know exactly what's going on in that noisy. I'm going to be very picky about this one. So if you think you know what it is, like Bob, and Bob, yes, I want you to use the email, or if you heard a cool noisy this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now, when I say email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, that is specifically not info@theskepticsguide.org or questions@theskepticsguide.org.
Because when you send it to those, we all see it.
Yes. Send it to WTN. Just so everybody understands, if I get anything other than that, I ignore it. Just because I need to have my email come in so I know what's what.
Right.
Very organized. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
Have a wonderful week.
All right. Very quick email. This is a follow-up to the Dino Tail and Amber story that we discussed with Brian Sweetek a few weeks ago. This comes from Garrett Kruger, who writes in part, I emailed once before. I co-host the dinosaur podcast, I Know Dino, with my wife. And I have a few more details about the dinosaur tail discovery I thought you might find interesting. To your question of how they know it wasn't a fake, the amber from this region of Myanmar actually fluoresces a characteristic blue when bombarded with UV light, which makes for a convenient way to authenticate it. Cool. To the question,
a fingerprint.
Yeah, to the question of whether some sort of scientific review could be put in place for Myanmar amber deposits. So what we were talking about, as an aside, was, you know, why is this showing up on the market? Why can't they just, you know, have scientists look to see if there's anything interesting in the amber before it goes to the market? And so Garrett says, the area in Myanmar where the amber is found isn't currently controlled by the government. It's under the control of the Kachin Independence Army, which effectively prevents regulation of Burmese amber in the region. Yeah. As a result, scientists have to go to the market independently and purchase the amber there. But the government is hopeful that they might regain control through negotiations soon.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Hmm.
Plus, I bet now that they know that somebody in the market found an essentially priceless, you know, piece of amber, that they're really scrutinizing the crap out of this amber now and just jacking up the price. I would bet the price is just even – look, at there's a little pebble in this amber. That's $5,000 for this pebble.
they did say pebble. That the scientists published on Two Wings found earlier, and that they have collected 9 more specimens – which they haven't published yet. So they did buy up a lot of it before they published anything, which sounds like a good idea. So anyway, yeah, hopefully that we'll get that under some kind of government control, so maybe we could get these scientists to do a first pass over that amber before it goes to the market. Cool. Thank you for that extra information, Garrett Kruger, and we'll have to take a listen to your I Know Dino podcast.
Yeah, very cool.
All right, guys, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by David Gorski. David, welcome back to the SGU.
Hey, thanks for inviting me here.
And David, of course, is the managing editor of Science-Based Medicine. You are a cancer surgeon and one of the few really, I would say, activist skeptical physicians that we have out there every day trying to fight for science and medicine. And we had to bring you on this week because two things happened, you know, basically back to back. Two issues dealing with vaccines, which is a topic that we talk about quite a bit on SBM. So I thought I had to bring you on so we could support each other.
we're gonna need to do that over the next however long this goes.
This is more group therapy than anything else.
Yeah.
The first item, and this one's very close to home for you, was the medical director of the Cleveland Clinic. The Wellness Center had a few things to say. Tell us about that.
I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name. It's Dr. Niedis or something like that. Dr. Daniel Niedis wrote a column for a local website, cleveland.com, in which he basically, it was basically an anti-vaccine rant, something of the sort that you would find on naturalnews.com, actually, or Age of Autism, or the Thinking Moms Revolution, or any of a number of anti-vaccine websites. It had the usual tropes: the toxins, the too many too soon, the adjuvants, you know, the evils of aluminum. It was framed in kind of a weird way. It sounded, if you looked at the title, like a typical post New Year's resolution, you need to detoxify or lose weight or whatever. But it took him about a paragraph before he went off the rails on an anti-vaccine rant. He even concluded it by basically quoting someone recommending the Food Babe as a source of medical of diet information.
Oh, the Food Babe. Can you imagine?
God. Nice. Yeah.
Whoa.
Wait, what exactly did he say about the Food Babe, though? Is this somebody that is that likes her, or somebody?
I mean, basically near the end, he quoted someone who recommended the Food Babe as a source of good information. And it turns out, I went back and looked at some of his older columns. Some of them were fairly benign. At least a couple of them went into full anti-GMO mode. You know, against the, you know, everybody's favorite anti-Roundup rants.
Yeah.
So he's been at this a while. So this was published on Friday, January 6th. Over the weekend, there was, you know, there was basically a Twitter meltdown over the whole thing. And the Cleveland Clinic communications office finally got involved and said, you know, on Sunday posted how it was very, you know, we are pro-vaccine, we support vaccine, we support evidence-based, you know, prevention of infectious diseases, and Dr. Neides will be disciplined. Not surprisingly, the anti-vaccines movement was very, very much happy about this. And yeah. And the other thing that was kind of interesting was the reaction of a lot of, you know, integrative physicians. Is like, they're shocked that there's an anti-vaccine, you know, there's anti-vaccine views in integrative medicine.
That's of course, and it's hard to imagine that they're being intellectually honest, right? It's like what they're basing their treatments on is quackery from beginning to end. And then they try to get moralistic about one particular bit of quackery. I mean, they basically have no ground to stand on. And same thing with Cleveland Clinic. I mean, you know, you allow a quack to head one of your centers, you can't be surprised when they do exactly what you hired them to do, which is to promote nonsense.
There is that, but what makes it troublesome, and the Cleveland Clinic is one of the worst offenders. I don't know if it is the worst, but it's definitely like in the top five as far as having the wellness center, the integrative medicine center. You know, it's been going on for 10 years. I cited, for instance, their Reiki fact sheet. Have you ever read that thing?
Oh, my God.
It basically goes on about how Reiki is the use of, you know, derives energy from the universal source, which the Reiki master channels into the patient, you know, totally credulous. There's like nothing there that's the least bit questioning of it. It's all this mystical mumbo jumbo, which is what Reiki is. And it's there as though it were facts. Right on the website. But this has been going on for a long time. You know, Reiki, Cleveland Clinic has been doing this for a long time. One of the things I noticed going through their website is they sell a lot of stuff. You know, like they sell supplements. They sell a homeopathic detox kit. They sell diet stuff, and, you know, they sell stuff that's fairly benign, like, you know, Cleveland Clinic branded tchotchkes, but they also sell all this nonsense. You know, they sell Metagenics products. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but it's a big line of supplements. They're very much into detox. Now, there's a history. We'll go back a couple years. The Cleveland Clinic got some notoriety back in 2014 for kind of what I like to call a 1-2 punch of quackery. First, they set up, and I know you blogged about this too, they set up the traditional Chinese medicine herbal clinic.
In the hospital?
No, but it's Cleveland Clinic branded.
All right, so it's in their group.
It's a clinic. Yeah. It's owned by the Cleveland Clinic. So it's, no, I don't believe it's on the main campus, but it's Cleveland Clinic branded. And truth be told, the wellness center that this director runs, I know where it is. It's a few miles up the road from where Cleveland Clinic is. It's not actually, I don't believe it's actually on the main campus. It's in Lyndhurst. But even so, it's still part of the Cleveland Clinic system.
Right. It doesn't matter that it's up the road. People will say this is the Cleveland Clinic. They're not going to make any kind of distinction between one center or the other.
I mean, I like to joke that, you know, well, I kind of did joke. It's like, you know, they like to make money off of the wealthy people in Beechwood. Beechwood is a suburb. I used to live in Cleveland, so I'm very familiar with Cleveland. Beechwood is a, you know, right near Shaker Heights, and they're wealthy suburbs of Cleveland. And these are the types of suburbanites who would be attracted to this stuff. Now, the two part of the 1-2 punch in 2014, and it also relates to the next part we're going to talk about, is that Cleveland Clinic hired Dr. Mark Hyman to set up a center. It's Center for Functional Medicine. And Steve's familiar with functional medicine. We've written about it. It's one of these things where they basically, it's hard to describe, but it's basically the worst aspects of conventional medicine, like weaponized for woo. Basically, they will measure like every lab value known to man and like put it together in these unvalidated ways and then try to correct any abnormalities that they find. And of course, if you order 100 lab tests, you're probably going to find at least five abnormal values the way they set up the norm ranges. And that's just by random chance alone. And not surprisingly, there's detox also in functional medicine. Mark Hyman, I've been writing about him since at least 2010. I remember one post he did where he talked about treating an autistic child with detoxification and various other things, and I think someone on my other blog made a good point, which is that it might not be all of this quackery that necessarily predisposes to anti-vaccine views, but detox quackery and anti-vaccine quackery go hand in hand. If you believe toxins make you ill, if you believe to treat disease you have to detoxify, that's like a straight line to anti-vax.
But I do think that means there is the deeper underlying connection, which is they all represent a rejection of solid principles of science-based medicine, right? I mean, once you open the door to these loose criteria they have, and functional medicine is like the poster child for pseudoscience, because it very much tries to surround itself in the trappings of science by ordering lab tests, as you say. And I don't know if you've read some of the reports. It's like poetry, in that it's it's unbelievable the kind of shit they're pulling out of their ass. But it is technobabble, right? We had the technobabble.
Called it technobabble before.
Absolutely technobabble.
I've called it woobabble.
Yeah,
it's basically.
I like it.
I talked about a quote unquote case report before. But I mean, they ordered like literally 100 lab tests, many of which are not validated. They're like, okay, so basically they're trying to correct all these things, and then they throw all these supplements at the woman, and then they tell her, to get more sleep, get some exercise, and they got someone to help her get to her appointments. And I'm like, the only thing they did that helped her was telling her to get more sleep, get more exercise, and find that person who could help her get to her medical appointments. And that's actually how integrative medicine gets you. It puts that sort of stuff in, claims there's something alternative about it, mixes it with the woo until the average patient and even a lot of doctors can't tell what's evidence-based and what's not. Okay, right. I'll settle down now. I'm getting worked up here.
Yeah, and then they just charge you a premium for all the bullshit that they throw in on top. It's interesting that you notice that the wellness center is catering to sort of the rich suburbanites, because I've absolutely noticed, at least in Connecticut, because I lecture to a lot of the area hospitals. So in my experience with the hospitals in Connecticut, there is a pretty direct correlation between how wealthy the community is and the amount of woo nonsense that the hospital is pushing.
Which makes sense. It makes sense.
So my experience is, and I'm sure I know you have the same experience, but when I talk to my fellow physicians who are just naive about it, it's not that they're shruggies. It's that they have no concept of what's happening in the real world. And when they do get exposed to it, they are genuinely scandalized. They are like, oh, they had no idea this was going on. They really are sheltered. It is more of an ivory tower syndrome than it is that they don't care.
There was an article on this whole thing, and I forget the guy's name, but they interviewed an integrative physician from MassGen, in Boston. And he was going, oh, none of the integrative docs I know are anti-vaccine. They all, and I'm like, well, number one, you run a wellness center that's mostly quote unquote mind body. So you're not into detox woo probably, although maybe you are. Two, you're in an ivory tower. If you get out into, a little lower down the food chain, you would see this stuff.
But I also would guess they probably are, but they know what to say and what not to say to the academic people. They absolutely have one set of things that they say when they're talking to academics, and then they say something else on their website. In fact, when I confronted that at Yale once, and they, who were, again, naive colleagues who were falling for, you know, the all the niceties, you know, the cleaned up version of the alternative medicine nonsense. And then I said, yeah, but look what they're saying on their website. And one of my colleagues actually said to me, oh, I'm sure they just say they don't really believe that. They're just saying that on their website for marketing.
It's like, what? Well, that is all a lazy answer.
Yeah, it's a lazy answer.
It also doesn't matter. It also does not matter.
I know.
Yes.
Like, first of all, that's no defense. And second, no, they really believe this. And then eventually I was able to prove to them that they do, but they were shocked that they
actually.
It's like, well, so none of you looked at the website, and if you did, you didn't take it seriously, and that's a failure. You failed.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of why I couldn't resist putting a video clip from Casablanca where Captain Renault goes, I'm shocked that there's gambling going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. Perfect.
You know, the guy comes in and says, you're winning, sir. He's like, oh, thank you. No, it's like...
Winning.
All right. Before we transition to the second item, I just want to finish this up with one question for you, Dave. What do you think will come of this, if anything? Because at least in the short term damage control, Cleveland Clinic is saying, oh, we're going to focus more on evidence-based medicine and maybe stop selling homeopathy out of our, you know, clinic. But
you're right. There was a news story that came out that basically, you know, the Cleveland, you know, that said that the Cleveland Clinic was thinking more of, getting rid of the homeopathy, you know, like the, being more evidence-based, cleaning house, so to speak.
Yeah.
What I think will probably happen is this doctor will be disciplined somehow, whether he's fired or not, I don't know. He should be, but he probably won't be. And then all the other doctors in the Integrative Medicine Center will know never to say anything anti-vax.
Mm-hmm.
So what will happen, I think the Cleveland Clinic is genuinely burned. I just don't know how sticky its reforms, whatever it decides to do, will be because of the cult there. So yeah. I suspect they'll clean up their act for a while, but how long that lasts or what, you know, whether it's anything permanent or how long it takes before it comes, you know,
I
have no idea.
All right, let's move to the next one because we were getting all hot and bothered about the Cleveland Clinic, and then something perhaps even bigger happened with Donald Trump and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So tell us about that, Dave.
Just to connect the stories.
Yeah,
because Mark Hyman is in both stories. So that's the other thing I forgot to mention. If they haven't gotten rid of Mark Hyman, Cleveland Clinic ain't serious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because he's about, you know, I guarantee you he's as anti-vax as, you know, in my opinion, as anything, you know, that they criticize there. So, but in any case, he wrote a book with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. 2 years ago called, you know, something, Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak. It's basically an anti-vaccine book of the Thimerosal Mercury fear-mongering variety.
Let the Science Speak, huh?
It's kind of funny. Paul Offit had a nice crack about that. He said, the science has already spoken. But in any case, Donald Trump, who, as we know, or as we should have known but didn't, met with Andrew Wakefield while he was on the campaign trail, thanks to a Florida chiropractor who with political connections, decided this week that he, for whatever reason, he would meet with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So there's the connection with the Cleveland Clinic, because Mark, you know, Cleveland Clinic, Mark Hyman, you know, Robert F. Kennedy, and now he's meeting with Trump. So it's not clear exactly what happened. The news, it started out with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. saying that Trump asked him to chair a commission or a committee of some sort on vaccine safety. And that was the initial wave of stories. A little later, the Trump organization said, no. We didn't actually ask him to do that. No decision has been made. We might have some sort of autism panel or, you know, but, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. So what actually happened is unclear. It could well have been, but the point is the two met to talk about something, which sounds like vaccines and autism, you know, as far as we, you know, I don't think Kennedy is lying that this was the topic that they talked about, you know, and we all know that Donald Trump has a long history of saying anti-vaccine things and tweeting things like about how a monster shot causes autism.
But David, who are we to believe here? What Robert Kennedy says or what Donald Trump's team is saying now about this? So we got two different things going on.
It's not clear who to believe. I would argue either version is horrible.
Well, yeah. Sure, yeah.
So, I mean, one's somewhat more horrible than the other, but they're both horrible. You know, this is a guy, this is someone that no president should ever be meeting with about vaccines. And even if was a commission on autism, it's a guy who no one should ever be meeting with about autism either. This guy has no expertise in autism, no expertise in the science. He has no clue about autism. He is on record as not once, but twice, and probably many more times that we don't know about, likening, you know, the quote-unquote autism epidemic to the Holocaust.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Wow. No hyperbole
what does
there.
That even mean?
And he even said it. The one that got him in trouble is he said, you get this baby, you know, the baby gets his shots, gets a fever, and within 3 months, boom, his brain is gone. He actually said that, you know?
His brain is gone?
Yes, he did. He said that.
Is this at a bar late at night or something?
And he said then he likened it to the Holocaust. He did actually apologize, but it wasn't a real apology. It basically boiled down to, as I put it, it was something along the lines of he was so emotional over autism that he was struggling for the right term, which I interpreted as saying, autism is so horrible that I just got a little carried away, you know, it's like by saying it's a Holocaust. Now, this is imagery. This is imagery that's very common on anti-vaccine websites, likening, you know, the quote unquote autism epidemic to the Holocaust. And
well, they must all be emotionally distraught.
But it's a very common.
Does that mean that, like, they think there's a vast conspiracy to, like, a eugenics conspiracy happening?
Some of them do. Vaccines? Some of them do, yes.
Wow.
Now, this is not the first time Kennedy did this. Like, two years before, this is a little bit of a funny story. He was speaking at Autism One, you know, that quack fest that they have every year for, you know, the anti-vaccine movement. And he apparently thought whatever he said wouldn't get be made public, but one of the Age of Autism bloggers couldn't resist writing about it very enthusiastically, where he basically said that having autism was like being imprisoned in a Nazi death camp.
Mm-hmm.
Like your mind is imprisoned, like having your mind imprisoned in a Nazi death camp.
Nice simile there.
Anyway,
makes
that the post where this was described was up for like all of a day, because I suspect he probably heard about it and told him to take it down. But, you know, I had seen it already and written about it, and so did several others.
The quick summary of RFK Jr.'s beliefs, Kara, and he's made this perfectly clear to journalists, et cetera, and of course in his writings, he thinks that there is a conspiracy that the CDC knows that vaccines cause a host of neurological disorders, including autism, and they're covering it up in order to protect the profits for the vaccine companies, which also know. So this is a conspiracy among the manufacturers, the CDC, therefore the government, and of course the medical establishment, because we have all the science, right? And
science-based medicine.
The media, he thinks the media are so intimidated by the CDC that they don't investigate their claims and won't contradict them. And of course,
So his conspiratorial thinking is like the capitalist medical industrial complex. Right. Like they just want to make money, and it's okay if they kill kids in the process. And then like some of the followers of this, some of the like really hardcore crazy, go deeper and say, no, they actually are intentional.
Yeah, no, he thinks that on some level it's intentional. But the other thing is, when you say, well, how do you know this is happening? And he has two pillars of evidence. One is his gross misreading of the scientific evidence, because he's not a scientist. Mm. He doesn't know what the F he's talking about, and he just misinterprets it. And then the second thing, and this is where I think I actually would not be surprised if this guy was diagnosable, because he's really frankly delusional. He has a conversation with a scientist, and then after that conversation, he says the scientist admitted to me that he knows that vaccines cause autism and that he's covering it up. And then, of course, the journalist says, "Oh, well, okay, let me go to that scientist and see and have him confirm it." And the scientist says, "I never said anything like that.
Wow,
he's completely misrepresenting what I said." And what Kennedy appears to be doing is confirmation bias motivated reasoning. He's latching on to anything the scientist says, which he can twist out of context to confirm what he believes. So like if the scientist says, well, of course we need to research, you know, to make sure that the that vaccines aren't causing autism. Kennedy hears, we know it's causing autism and we're covering it up.
Yeah.
So I think he probably really believes it, which is scary. But that's his evidence, his own delusions and his own Dunning-Kruger ignorance of medical science.
Oh, speaking of Dunning-Kruger, wow. There was he gave an interview to Science Magazine. You know, there was a Q&A. I guess they caught him in the airport. And he says, oh, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I'm an environmental lawyer, and I can recognize junk science when I see it. And I'm like, whoa, and my reaction was, no, you can't. The stuff you cite is from, like, you know, is the worst of the worst that I've like spent a blogging career deconstructing because it's so bad.
Now, and just to wrap this up, we have to point out that it's been 15 years since thimerosal was removed from the routine vaccine schedule. And all of the thimerosals causing autism anti-vaxxers, including RFK and all everyone else, was predicting autism rates are going to plummet. They're going to plummet once they take thimerosal out of the vaccines. And they didn't plummet. There wasn't a blip. They continued on the same path they were on without the slightest statistical change. And they kept delaying and delaying. Well, it takes time. And, you know, there's still some vaccines out there with thimerosal in it and blah, blah, blah. But now it's been 15 years. Not
just, you
blip.
Wait now.
So you there's, wait. There's any day no now. Way to avoid the conclusion that thimerosal was not causing autism because its removal had no effect on autism rates. And anyone with the slightest sliver of intellectual integrity would have to admit that. And as David said, in 2014, he published a book still banging the thimerosal drum. He will never give it up.
Right. And I mean, wow. The other thing, we were talking, those of us who were writing about these things were talking about this in 2007 and 2008, how if there was going to be a decrease in autism incidence, we should be starting to see it now, you know, yeah. And it
Ten
and
years
we weren't,
yeah.
10 years.
You know, like 2008, roughly, you know, because, you know, by then 6 years had passed, you know, and autism is most commonly diagnosed between roughly what, age 3 and 5.
Yeah.
And so
at before.
You know, the kids who were born when thimerosal was removed are in high school now. You know, it's like
yeah it's done.
Yeah, they would have had the diagnosis.
So.
It's done.
Yeah.
Well, but then they just move the goalpost, right? They just say that. Well, yeah, but there's still thimerosal in other vaccines, or like they're not telling you, but there's still trace amounts.
Well, they do talk about because there
you.
Are there. It's true. There's trace amounts in a few vaccines, you know, but it's many, many times less than, you know, was there before. And if you make that argument, then you would have to say, well, there's less thimerosal in the childhood vaccine schedule than there has been any time since like the 1980s or something. So why hasn't autism incidence fallen back to what it was in the 1980s? You know, it's like,
they don't care about dose response curves. Like, that's
well,
not going
to they do when it
in.
Seems to support their position. So, again, their logic was, yeah, that we're giving more and more thimerosal to our kids, and autism is increasing. And, of course, as we love to point out, so was the organic food industry. But anyway, it's all just so it was internet usage and cell phone usage and whatever and sunspots, whatever. It's all just correlation without causation. But in any case, they said, so if increasing thimerosal was increasing autism, then decreasing thimerosal should decrease autism. You can't avoid that logic. That's basic dose response, as you say. But they're saying, no, because the slightest sliver of thimerosal got in there, and that's causing all the autism. It's like, no, you have no idea what you're talking about. That's wrong. And it doesn't even make sense. As David said, we should be back to whatever the autism rates were in the early 1980s or 1970s or whatever. There's just the tiniest amount now. It's like a hundredth or less than a hundredth of what it was at its peak at the end of the 1990s.
But on the other hand, they'll say, but there's more vaccines which make up for the difference. You know, it's like,
but it doesn't.
They
could
make up. No, I know, but I'm just saying there's more vaccines and the whole other things in vaccines that can cause autism, according to them, is making up for that. It's hiding the decline, you know. I've heard that.
It's perfectly, perfectly hiding it. Right.
Just moving the goalposts.
They're immune to evidence. Like, you know, immune to
doubling
evidence.
Doubling down. Yeah.
Well, David, we have our work cut out for us. We'll have to keep an eye on all of this.
Yeah, I think that
Yep.
Whether or not anything comes of this, whether or not there is actually a committee or a commission or whatever run by RFK Jr., even if there isn't, this is just the first volley in the vaccines. There will be something else. I mean, unfortunately, Donald Trump's history with respect to vaccines and his frequent repeating of the view that, you know, of his belief that vaccines can cause autism makes it inevitable that sooner or later someone's going to get his ear and he's going to want to do something. You know, it's going to happen again, even if nothing comes of this meeting with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
I agree. That was my concern, too. What this shows us is that Trump is going to be the anti-vaccine president. It wasn't just something he was tweeting about. He actually intends to do something about it, to act on his unscientific views. And as you could say, he can't dismantle everything single-handedly, but he could certainly do a lot of damage in 4 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. His anti-vaccine views, he's been saying this stuff for 9 years at least. It's probably his most consistent belief that I've been able to find is that vaccines cause autism. He hasn't changed since 2007, which is the first time I noticed him saying these things.
Scary.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks again for your good work at Science-Based Medicine. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Great job. It's
been
fun.
David.
Thanks, man.
Yep. Bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just have three regular news items this week. Kara, you missed my sweep last week to your benefit, but we'll see.
Who knows if it would have happened if I'd been.
Yeah, we'll see how you do this week. It would have. Okay. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that exercising only on the weekends, compared to being inactive, has no measurable benefit in terms of heart health and mortality. Item number two, scientists have genetically engineered a Salmonella bacterial species to seek out and destroy glioblastoma tumor cells and have successfully tested the treatment in rats. And item number three, the Hubble Space Telescope has discovered a probable new exoplanet using a unique method by imaging a shadow cast upon a ring of dust surrounding the parent star. Kara, since you had to miss science fiction last week, I'll let you go first this week.
All right. A new study finds that exercising on the weekends only, compared to being completely inactive, it doesn't say completely, but inactive, has no measurable benefit in terms of heart health and mortality. Well, that's dumb. I could see one study finding that, though, but overall that doesn't make any sense because so many studies have shown that just any attempt to not be sedentary is an improvement. Scientists have genetically engineered a Salmonella bacterial species to seek out and destroy glioblastoma tumor cells and have successfully tested treatment in rats. Okay, so genetically engineered Salmonella, maybe Salmonella infect glioblastoma easily. I don't know how they could tell it to seek it out, put some sort of antigen on it or something. Okay, and then the Hubble Space Telescope has discovered a probable new exoplanet using a unique method, imaging a shadow cast upon a ring of dust surrounding the parent star. Huh. Okay, so that would make sense. It's kind of like the way that we do transit of Venus or any of those other things where if there's a shadow, then something might be in front of it, and that could tell us it might be an exoplanet. Gosh, you know, the annoying thing is that the genetically engineered Salmonella and the Hubble telescope seem reasonable, and the inactive one, you know, the exercise one seems completely unreasonable, which means there's no way that's a fiction because that's too easy. Or is it? Steve, you're messing with my mind. I'm going to Occam's razor this one, and I know it's going to bite me in the ass, but I'm going to say I think that the study about exercise will ultimately be found to be fiction, but it could be science that this study found this. And the fiction – and there's a lot of different parameters to the genetically engineered Salmonella, so I'm going to say that's the fiction. Oh, help me.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, I know what you're saying there, Kara, but I'm going to say the Hubble thing, yeah, that's –
That's totally doable. Although I'm trying to think of, you know, if the dust ring is in the same orbit as a bona fide exoplanet, how much of a shadow is it going to cast if it's in the same plane orbiting in the same direction? That makes it a little bit dicey, but I could see that happening. The salmonella and the bacteria, yeah. I just want to believe that so damn much. I've been waiting for years for them to genetically modify some bacteria to do some awesome shit just like this. I think it's doable. We're going to do it at some point. Let's make it now. That's fantastic. So that's just too awesome to say no, although I'm sure it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. The exercising one, you know, that there's just not enough information here. I think that if somebody does 2 hours of cardio on Saturday and 2 hours on Sunday, that's 4 hours of cardio. Bullshit that there's not going to be any measurable benefit just because it's on the weekend. That even a little exercise is so much better. Even gardening is so much better. So yeah, I mean, if you do a good chunk of exercise on the weekends, that will have a benefit. So I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
My gut is telling me that the exercise one is science because, you know, even a little bit of low impact walking is better than nothing and has some type of benefit. Now, the key term in here might be measurable. And that's the word that's pissing me off. That or the word study. That word's really pissing me off.
So, about the word on. Is that pissing you off?
See, Bob, what if you exercised for like 5 hours on the weekend?
Right, exactly. There's no way that could have no measurable benefit.
If you only exercised for 5 minutes? Then it would have no measurable
benefit. Yeah, but all of that, Steve doesn't elucidate us on the time frame. He just says on the weekend, which is basically 2 days out of a 7-day week.
And it's just one study.
Okay, so we'll put that one down for a second. The one about the genetically engineered salmonella, absolutely, I think that they... You know, I know that they're working on stuff like this. I think that this is very likely that they found some type of way to engineer a bacteria to do something, seek out and destroy. It's like a hunter-seeker bacteria to eat cancer.
Terminator, yeah. This Good? Better be damn true, Steve. Yeah. I'm just telling you right now.
Yeah, right. Now, this one about the Hubble Space Telescope is really interesting. So I'm trying to dissect this. They're saying that the Hubble saw a probable exoplanet by using the following method. It's imaging the shadow cast upon the ring of dust that surrounds the parent's star. So they're seeing a shadow that's cast on this dust cloud surrounding a star. Now, first and foremost, what kind of dust cloud would be surrounding a star? And does that tell me about the age of the star? And if there's a dust cloud around the star, sure, that seems possible. I don't know if the Hubble Space Telescope saw that or if they're trying to use that method to look for exoplanets. And then this one about the exercise. You know what? I think the exercise one, I've got to go with it and say that this one is not science. It's the fiction. The exercise is wrong.
Okay, and Evan.
Hubble Space Telescope, sure, the imaging cast upon imaging a shadow cast upon a ring of dust surrounding the parent star. Very cool. I hope that one's right. I also hope the salmonella one is right. It's about time we took control of these bacterias and viruses and other bugs crawling all over the planet and use them for our benefit. About time. The exercise one, I think I'm with Bob and Jay on this one, that this one's going to be the fiction because of a lot of things Bob said. A little bit of exercise compared to no exercise does show benefits, and I think this hits that category.
Ugh, I'm sorry. So, I'm stressing.
Fiction. Don't stress. Listen to this song, Kara. Don't stress out. It's the exercise one, Steve. I think that one is fiction.
All right,
fiction.
So the guys think the exercise one is fiction. Kara is all by herself and thinking that the salmonella one is fiction.
Oh, boy. Sweet
which
Jesus.
Means you all agree that the Hubble Space Telescope has discovered a probable new exoplanet.
Yeah, and we're going to stick together on that one, Steve.
A unique method by imaging a shadow cast upon a ring
Very
of dust
unique.
Surrounding the parent star. You all think that one is science.
And
he sounds
that so
one
happy.
Is
Stardust.
Science. Uh-oh. It's science.
Oh. Yeah, baby.
Oh, no, sweet. Right, at least I got somewhere.
Glad to have you back, Kara.
Yeah. Kara. Now, I did do one thing in the description of the study, though, where I implied something that I think you all then inferred, but I didn't say it specifically. The shadow was not being cast by the planet.
Oh.
What?
Right? But you might think,
oh, Trixie.
That was shitty.
What was casting the shadow?
Just shitty. That's all.
What's casting the shadow is an inner ring of dust.
What?
So you have an inner ring of dust casting a shadow on an outer ring of dust.
It can detect
But the planet is affecting
in between
the inner ring and is and therefore the shadow is rotating around the star following the orbit of the planet.
That is complicated.
It's complicated, but that's what's happening.
I need to
so
see
that's why
that.
They said it's a probable exoplanet because they're not directly or observing the planet. They're not observing the planet's shadow. They're observing the planet's gravitational effect on an inner ring of dust, which is casting a shadow on an outer ring.
Damn.
So interesting, right? So it's not, of course, confirmed that this is an exoplanet, but that's the best explanation that they have for this. And it's circling around the parent star in a 16-year period, which is a pretty good, you know, duration for a planet to, you know, a planet to be going around its star. So then that's, you know, the first time that they've used this kind of evidence to infer the presence of an exoplanet. So pretty cool.
And Hubble did it, which, I mean, it's that's not still, its forte or fort.
I mean, Hubble is just...
Hubble's still cranking out the science.
Are you buying this shit?
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Okay, yeah. Just a
second. Still my favorite telescope.
Yeah. I buy it.
You all bought it, apparently. Okay.
What I'm frustrated about is that I agree with you about number one. I just think the wording allows it to be science.
Well, let's go back to number one then.
Okay.
A new study finds that exercising only on the weekends compared to being inactive has no measurable benefit in terms of heart health and mortality. Kara, you think this one is science. The guys all think this one is fiction. Although, Kara, you disagree with the outcome. You think that a study did show this.
Yeah, I think a study could have shown it, but it will be ultimately lost to history because so many other studies would discount it.
Yeah, I'll say right now that I don't really think Steve would list something as science that he knows is clearly refuted by so much stuff that it will eventually be found to be bullshit.
Well, but Bob, I don't think he would do that. Let's see, win from last week might have gone to his head.
We'll see. I mean, if it's a peer-reviewed study, then it's in the scientific literature. Whether it's good science is another question.
Well, yeah. Bob is right, because this one is the fiction.
Then it was too easy.
Yes, it was.
Off the schneid.
But I got to do that every now and then to throw you off.
Yes, he does.
So I overthought it, and all of you didn't.
No, I kind of gave up trying to second-guess Steve and just go, just go with my gut and go with what science I know. And this from the guy who came in last place last year, so don't even listen to me.
You guys heard me do that, too. I literally said, I'm going to Occam's razor this and say, and then I changed my mind.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
Damn it. Okay, I guess we're all tied now.
No, actually, they got one win over you. But
yeah, that's true. But they also have a loss over me.
You all have one loss, but they have one win.
Damn it.
But anyway, it's too early in the year. Too early in the year.
I'm like crushed.
Never too early.
You can never come back out of this, Kara. You're done. You're done.
It's a funk. Yeah, yeah. Call it the funk.
Okay, what they did was a pooled analysis of 63,591 adult respondents. And what they found was that there was a 30% lower all-cause mortality risk in active versus inactive adults. And people who were so-called weekend warriors who got all of their recommended activity, which is either 150 minutes of moderate or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, all entirely on the weekend, either in one or two sessions, had the same benefit as people who spread out their exercise throughout the week. They all had that 30% reduction. So, yeah, it's a pretty good bet. I would always bet on any exercise being good all the time, always, because that's kind of what the literature shows, is that it's always better to do something than nothing. Any exercise is better than less exercise, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were right, Kara. And again, this study does show that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's you could do 21 minutes of moderate activity a day, and that's enough. That would hit the recommended amount.
Yeah, just I still 21 think, though, that minutes. Maybe this one study, we shouldn't all stop exercising every other day and only do it on the weekends.
Of course not. Listen, no one study is ever definitive. And obviously, a lot of the times in science or fiction, I'm reporting on one study. But I do try to limit it to studies that I think are reasonable. You know,
valid,
I wouldn't report as fact a study that I think is bullshit. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
But, right. But the fact remains, I think if you just add up your activity for the week, think of it as a weekly aggregation, and that was good enough. That's good enough. If your weekly is good, is close, then you're pretty much good enough.
Yeah, so basically it means if you get 150 minutes of moderate or 75 minutes of vigorous activity per week, no matter how you divvy it up, you're fine. That's basically what this study is showing. But the other thing to remember, Kara, is that since this is the fiction, nothing matters, right? I don't have to believe in this study because it's fiction, the way I reported it. So keep that in mind, too.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's
true. So, and oftentimes I will do that. Like a study will show something and I want to talk about the study, but I don't want to endorse the outcome of the study. So if I make it the fiction, then nothing matters then, right? You could disbelieve anything you want because it was the bottom line was that it was fiction. Anyway.
Fake news.
Right. But I think it is a little bit reassuring because some people are busy during the week, but they do get very physical on the weekends. And it's nice to know that that's okay. You know, that's still worthwhile.
And now I'm questioning whether I exercise too much because I work out every day.
That's fine.
I go to the gym every other day and I do cardio on the days I'm not at the gym.
That's a reasonable schedule.
No, that's fine. I mean, don't forget, those numbers he gave were kind of like the lower limit. You go higher than that.
That's not much.
That's the minimum.
Yeah, you'll get even more benefits.
That's like New Yorkers get that just going to work.
Yeah. No, and they even say, like, even if you like just take the stairs instead of an elevator at work, that counts too. Anything is good. Just anything you could do to squeeze in a little bit more exercise throughout your life is a good thing. That's the bottom line.
That's what my Fitbit says. Yep.
Yeah. So, and partly it all, I think some people think, oh, I like don't have the time or whatever, or the resources to like go to the gym and really work out. So they don't do anything. And I think it's an important message to get out there is that don't do that, right? Don't talk yourself out of doing a little bit of exercise because you don't think there's any benefit to it. And because you're not doing more vigorous or more consistent exercise, just do whatever you can.
Right.
Yeah,
anything that you could do will have that incremental amount of health benefit.
Also in the past about studies that show that if you are sedentary, like 8 hours a day behind your computer at work, that's really bad. It's really bad. It's like, it's almost like smoking. It's like that bad.
Yeah, but the research is not settled on that. The question is,
what's the
being
latest?
Sedentary, like is sitting an independent risk factor or can you undo the health risk of being sedentary, of sitting by exercising? And
the jury's out, you're saying?
The jury's out on that. I think there's some evidence that says, you can actually undo it by exercising. And other studies that suggest that sitting by itself is a risk factor and not undone by exercising. But I think my bottom line is the jury's still out on that one. In any case, move more. That's the bottom line. Move more.
Look, we don't know what the effect is by not exercising as much as we know what the effect is by exercising.
We definitely know that's beneficial.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so bottom line, just to be safe, if you're behind a computer 8 hours a day, you know, get up every couple hours and walk for 5 minutes even, 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Walk around. I go, like in the winter, I'll get up from my desk once or twice a day and go into the parking garage and just walk up and down for like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, sometimes more. And that really, you know, kind of re-energizes you a bit. And it just that way you're just not sitting for 8-9 hours a day.
Or you can just drink a shitload of water while you work because then you're going to have to get up to pee.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. All of this means that scientists have genetically engineered a Salmonella bacterial species to seek out and destroy glioblastoma tumor cells and have successfully tested the treatment in rats is very cool science.
Oh, my God. Finally. Tell me about this.
Finally. What do you think about this, Steve?
Well, listen. Yeah, what do you think? This is again. It's rat study, right? So
what?
Whether this will translate to humans? Because
oh, come on! What are you talking about? They genetically engineered bacteria to do this awesome task. Of course, it's going to be applicable to humans. What are you talking about?
You know what I just realized,
please,
Steve?
Please.
what I realized.
You can't know
human
that.
Race, the human race is going to die, and there's going to be all this technology to keep mice and rats alive.
Oh, yeah.
They won't
the
know
benefactors.
What to do with it.
Yep.
But so this is what – very clever, right? Scientists can be very clever. This is what they did. So they – and they first very they genetically species. Engineered Salmonella typhimurium. That's the name of the species. They gave it a few genetic tweaks so that it would need to use purine as a food source. It so happens that glioblastoma, which is a really the worst kind of brain tumor, produces a lot of purine. So they will seek out the purine food source and thusly seek out the tumor. They also tweaked, genetically tweaked the bacteria so that in a low oxygen environment, they would self-destruct, and thereby delivering the protein that is designed to kill the tumor cells. And tumors, because they're so metabolically active, produce a low oxygen environment. So they seek out the places where the tumor is, then they self-destruct, and they take the tumor with it. So they're like little suicide bombers, I guess. And so the other good thing is that this also prevents the bacteria from causing an infection, because they're very dependent on purine, and they die very quickly. So they tested it in rats, and the rats essentially had a 20% 100-day survival rate. Now, that's where it becomes difficult to translate to humans. Now, the researchers say 100 days in a rat translates to roughly 10 years for a human, but those, that's where it gets tricky, is translating rat days into human years,
Jeez.
But, and it's still only 20% survival?
But so 20% survival, if we looked at that, if that exactly translates to humans, and humans with glioblastoma have a 20% survival rate for 10 years, that may not sound great, but that's fantastic for this tumor, which has a 5% 5-year survival at present. Indeed. And most people survive for about a year with it, so or like 14 months or something. It's a horrible tumor that really has been very resistant to our attempts at treating it. And so this would be huge. This would be huge.
Right.
If that exactly translates, as they said, to humans, that remains to be seen. Hopefully.
Yeah, Bob, what do you think of that?
Hopefully it will. And hopefully this is just the beginning and they'll continue to tweak it.
Right. Right. They barely tweaked. I mean, that's. Yeah. This is wonderful.
5 years, everybody.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are we, about 5 years out?
Five to 10 years.
Oh my God. This is fantastic. Come on.
So we'll see. I mean, this is it's a very clever strategy, and I love the fact that they're genetically engineering, bacteria to be our little, guided missiles, basically. For the
of course, they're amazing little pieces of machinery, bacteria. Yeah. There's so much we could do with them, before we're actually building them from the ground up, which will eventually happen. This is fantastic. I mean, come on. These things are just – they're so wonderful. If we could just tweak them a little bit, we can have them do things even far cooler than this.
So yeah, so I very much like this news item, and hopefully this will pan out and even go further. It'd be great.
I guess I like it too.
Evan, what's the quote this week?
All right, and continuing with my series of quotes from notable skeptics from around the world, it's when we are most desperate that we are at our most vulnerable. It's hard to be objective, to ask for the evidence, and to critically appraise it. But that's when it's probably most important. And that was written by Scott Govura. He's with Bad Science Watch, and he's also a contributor to Science-Based Medicine. Bad Science Watch is an independent, nonprofit consumer protection watchdog and science advocacy organization dedicated to improving the lives of Canadians by countering bad science. And they're doing really good work up in Canada, and we can only hope that other countries around the world have something equivalent of Bad Science Watch.
Yeah, Scott's one of our boys at Science-Based Medicine. He's a good guy.
Good guy.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.